Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Diana Catherine Plopa with Grey Wolf Publishing. Today we are speaking with author Donald Levin, who is just an amazing mystery writer. We're going to learn more about what he's doing, and the book today is called The Forgotten Child. It is fourth in the Martin Prius series, and we'll talk about that in a second. First of all, I want to make an announcement and say the Grey Wolf Scriptorium Bookshop is opening August 19th. So check our website and learn about all the exciting things that we're going to be doing there. Donald Levin's books will be featured at the bookshop, so drop on by and maybe you can get a signed copy. I apologize, Don, for my voice today. As you know, we were both at the Eastern Market event on Sunday, and I talked a little bit too much, so my voice is a little strained today. So welcome to the show, Don.
Thank you so much. No worries about your voice. I feel the same way. Talk more than I'm used to talking at that one.
Right.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So can you give me a little bit about your, just a quick, like, background on your writing experience? When did you start writing? And tell me a little bit about how you really got involved in writing police procedural mysteries. It's really a niche, so I'd like to hear about how you chose that as your genre.
Yeah, I've always been a writer, even when I was a little boy. I love to write. I always knew I was going to be a writer. I wrote things. When I was 8 years old, my father brought home a typewriter from his office, and I felt like a musician feels when you discover your instrument. You know, I felt like this was the thing I wanted to play for the rest of my life. So I always wrote. When I was younger, I don't know if you remember the Dragnet series with Jack Webb.
Oh, absolutely.
It was on the radio and it was on TV. I used to write scripts for the Dragnet show. My own scripts. So clearly I've had this affinity for police procedurals all along. I've been, in my time, I've written almost everything except journalism. I never really had an interest in journalism, but I've written, I was a professional writer for 20 years. I wrote speeches. I wrote video scripts. I wrote annual reports. I wrote news releases. I wrote advertising. I wrote public relations. I worked in hospital.
Wow.
I was the speechwriter for the commissioner.
Variety. Yeah.
Yeah. I was the speechwriter for the commissioner of the Department of Health in New York City, which was a fabulous gig. So I've always been a writer. And I've always wanted to write creatively. Not that other writing isn't creative, but I've always wanted to write stories. And several novels back in the 70s and 80s that didn't get published.
Mm-hmm.
I had an agent in New York for one of the books, which I was all excited about because he was the guy who sold The Towering Inferno to the movies. And I thought,
oh,
man, this is it.
Wow.
I have made it.
Yeah.
And he sent it was a mystery. It was a police procedural. And he sent that around for a couple of years, and he got it back, and he'd send it out, and he'd get it back, and he periodically would send me the responses. And finally he said, sent it back and said, you know, I really like this. I believe in it, but I can't do any more with it right now. There doesn't seem to be any interest. And
okay.
I was very discouraged at that. And so on
yeah,
top
I can,
of...
I can imagine how that kind of a rejection might kind of make you take pause for a few minutes.
It made me take pause for about 10 years, actually.
Okay.
I thought, well, you know, this is not for me. It was a good try, but obviously this isn't something that I'm meant for. So I stopped writing creatively and turned my attention to earning my living as a writer by writing advertising copy and public relations copy. And I was a freelance writer for a while. Writing video scripts and producing video scripts. I was big into video for a while. And as I started writing more and more things for other people, particularly when I moved to New York City, and I saw that I was writing all this stuff that other people were getting credit for, I was writing op-ed pieces for the Journal of the American Medical Association that my boss at the health department would sign. And I was writing op-ed pieces for the New York Times that my boss would sign and that Mayor Koch would sign. The pressure started to build to write again for myself. And finally, when I was it got to the point where I was walking down subway platforms in New York, and I was sort of having fantasies of pushing people off the platform, and I thought, no, this is not going to work. You gotta do something else here. So I started writing again. I started I wrote a novel, which I self-published, and at that time I had I decided that I really wanted to do something else with my life besides be a support writer for somebody else. So I went back to graduate school, and I got a PhD in English education, and wound up as an academic for the next 20 years. And as an academic, I wrote scholarly articles, but I also wrote fiction. I started writing stories again, started publishing short fiction. I started writing poetry. I published a lot of poetry. And I got an assignment at school to run the accreditation project in 2007. And as part of that, my duty was to write the accreditation report. And it wound up being a monumental report of like 300 pages. It was a three-year project.
It stopped
me writing poetry.
Yeah.
It was pretty daunting. It stopped me writing poetry completely. It brought my poetry career to a halt. But as I was working on the long piece, I remembered how good it felt to get involved in a long work. It's sort of like, you know, if you've been a marathon runner and then you started to be a sprinter and then suddenly you started running marathons again and you realized how good it felt to work in that long form. And that's what got me starting writing novels again.
Right. And it sounds like that's what led into this Martin Prius series was long works in short, it sounds like, you know, one novel at a time, but over a longer investigation of this genre and these characters. Does that sound about right?
It does. I think that's exactly right. And I was always, as I said, I was always a mystery fan. I read a lot of mysteries. I had this sort of conventional English professor, classic literature side, but the stuff I really enjoyed reading was the popular stuff, you know, the Henning Mankell, Ian Rankin. There were two Swedes who were sort of the grandparents of Swedish mysteries, Maj Sjöwall and Per Wallu, who wrote in the 60s. They have a series of 10 Martin Beck mysteries that they wrote in Sweden. And I discovered them and I fell in love with them. So we always tell students, write what you know, but the real truth of the matter is that people write what they read.
I tend to write more what draws me in than what I think other people will want.
Yeah, that's right. So I read this a very long answer to your question, but that's what got me into writing police procedurals because the books I was reading and the authors I liked were police procedural authors.
Okay. So tell me about Martin Prius. Where did he come from? And then I want you to tell me about Toby and how you came up with that character. I think it's really very striking that you included Toby, and I'll let you describe him a little bit, but I found Toby to be a really fascinating character, and he's one of those characters that I would really love to know more and more and more about him. So can you tell me about Martin and Toby?
Sure. Martin was a police detective with the Ferndale Police Department. And for those who don't know, Ferndale is an inner ring suburb just north of Detroit, just north of the famous 8 Mile in Detroit. And the books are set in Ferndale and range across the entire metropolitan Detroit area. So
that was one of the great parts about reading. that was one of the great parts about reading your books, is that I could recognize everything in them.
Yeah. I always tell people that they can hold their books, they can hold the books in their hand and go around Ferndale and find their way around Ferndale and navigate using those books, because I mentioned streets, I mentioned places, I mentioned restaurants. I've used them all fictionally, of course, but it's very much set in its locale.
It's nice to feel that familiar with a book. You know, it allowed me to become so much more involved in the story because I could absolutely see myself there.
Yeah. And I'm hoping that for people who don't know Ferndale, because it is so much, these books are so much stories of a particular place, even if they don't know where the streets are, they don't know where the restaurants are, because it's so faithfully reproduced, they can really get a sense of being there themselves.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Yeah. So he's Martin Pruse is a police detective. He is a widower. His wife has died 6 years before the first book opens, in an automobile accident after a fight that they had, where she took their two kids and threw them in their van, and she was headed up to Traverse City, which is where her mother lives. And the car was T-boned by a drunk driver. She was killed. The older son, Jason, was seriously injured, and the younger son, Toby, was packed in pillows in the back of the car, so he wasn't injured as much as his brother was. And, of course, he certainly wasn't injured as much as his mother was. Martin really comes out of me. He comes out of me, and he comes out of my sense that for your average police detective, they're not super detectives. They're people with lives, with families, who go to work and want to do a good job and want to come home at night. So he's not a super detective. He's a flawed guy. He's got his issues.
He is definitely a real person.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate your saying that. One of the things that makes him so real, and I think one of the things that adds to the richness of the books and certainly the richness of his character, is his relationship with Toby. Toby is his young son. He is in the latest book, The Forgotten Child, Toby is 17. Toby is profoundly multiply handicapped, and he lives in a group home because Martin can't take care of him with all of Toby's needs and the crazy schedule that Martin has as a police detective. He just finds that he can't take care of the boy at home. So regretfully, he has him in a group home, which is a wonderful group home, and Toby is very happy there. But
like how you wrote about the time that Martin spends with Toby, and it's so different. It's a wonderful dichotomy of the police procedural part and the human part of Martin. I love that he has that duality in him and that both sides get equal attention.
Yeah, and one feeds into the other. What happens usually in the books is that Martin spends as much time with Toby as he possibly can. Usually at the end of the day, he goes over and checks in with Toby, spends some time with him, spends a few hours with him. In the last book, The Forgotten Child, Martin is retired as a police detective, so he has a lot more time. So he goes over in the morning to help get Toby ready for his school program. He comes over in the afternoon to help get Toby off the bus and spend a few hours with him there. So Toby is, to my mind, the most important character of the book, because he helps his father stay centered. He helps his father understand what's important and what's not important. He helps the reader understand what's important and what's not important. And he also gives the reader a real sense of what it means to have a child with special needs. Not only the challenges, which is what everybody thinks about, but also the joys.
Right. And I thought that you depicted that balance really, really well. When I was reading your book, it gave me a true understanding of that balance and the importance of maintaining that balance. But it was so pleasant to read that part of the book, and then it was fun and exciting to go read the police stuff and then come back. It's kind of like, you know, you go out into the world and you do your exciting thing, and then you come home to home and hearth, you know. So I really felt like you had completely encapsulated a whole humanity within your story. So I was really pleased with that. I wonder if you might read a little bit, because I don't want us to run out of time without you doing that.
Oh, sure. Let me just say that Toby is based on my grandson, whose name was Jamie, and the relationship that Toby has with his father. So it's a very loving relationship that goes back and forth between the two of them. He's based mm-hmm. on the relationship that I had with Jamie, that my wife had with Jamie, that Jamie's mom had with Jamie. In fact, Jamie's no longer with us, unfortunately. He died in 2011. But Jamie's mom, yeah, thanks. We all miss him every day. You know, we think about him mm-hmm. constantly. And for me, these books are a way to keep him alive. When I started these books, I knew that there was going to be a Jamie-like character in them, just because I wanted to keep Jamie alive, and I knew Jamie had a particular, or Toby, I should say, had a particular role to play in his father's life. So
absolutely.
Let me...
I'd love to have you read a little bit, because I don't want to run out of time.
Okay. What I'll do is, with a mystery, it's particularly hard to pick out a little piece just to read, because everything connects with everything else. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick out a little section about Toby to give people a sense of what Toby is like and what he means for his father. So this is towards the beginning of the book. Toby, Martin goes to Toby's house at the end of the day, as he always does, and the section goes as follows.
Okay.
Toby was wide awake. Bruce leaned over the bed to enter his son's field of vision. "Hey, you," he said, and took the boy's twisted hand in his own. Bruce gave a gentle squeeze and sensed a tiny, almost imperceptible pressure in return. There were people, doctors, even some of his teachers, who thought Toby didn't have enough control over his body to squeeze his father's hand voluntarily. They discounted it as reflex activity. Bruce knew they were wrong. He knew what his son could do, even if others wouldn't admit it. Toby's abilities were subtle, it was true, but they were present if you knew how to appreciate them. Bruce did. He bent over and kissed the boy's cool forehead. "How's my sweet boy?" No vocal reply. Toby blinked and focused on his father's face. Times like this, with the unbroken eye contact Toby was making, Bruce's love for his child was almost overwhelming. The eye specialist who removed Toby's cataracts when he was only a week old said Toby could see only peripherally, out of the corners of his eyes, and the steady deterioration of his optic nerve would mean he would eventually go blind. Sometimes, like now, Toby seemed to look right at his father, his almond-shaped brown eyes examining Bruce's features with the same loving care that Bruce examined Toby's. Because Toby rarely made eye contact, the times when Toby looked right at him seemed particularly consequential. Bruce reached out and laid a cupped hand on Toby's cheek, warm and stubbled. When he first retired, Bruce hoped he might be able to take the 17-year-old back to his house in Ferndale to live. After Toby stayed overnight a few times, Bruce realized that wouldn't be possible. With his visual limitations, his profound cerebral palsy that left him unable to care for his own personal needs, his cognitive delays, his microcephaly, his seizure disorder, the delicate bird bones of his legs that couldn't hold up his weight and broke if too much pressure was applied during physical therapy. With all that, Toby needed more constant care than Bruce could manage as a single parent. Toby had to stay in his group home. Bruce queued up 3 Judy Collins albums on Toby's CD player, Toby's usual music to fall asleep by, and sat in the chair beside the bed. He held his son's hand, stiff and bent from the contractures of the cerebral palsy, but with slender, graceful fingers. They listened to Toby's favorite singer. The high notes of her powerful alto in the early recordings made the boy smile, and he sang along to the silvery soprano of her later songs with his own foghorn vocalizations. Her voice calmed him, and as he eased into sleep, Toby calmed his father as well. And then the chapter goes on from there to talk about why Proust needed calming at that particular point.
That's wonderful. We get such a rich sense of Toby in that passage. And that's what I really, really love about your writing, is that in each book, I just recently, not long ago, as you know, I finished Guilt and Hiding, and I really got a
yes.
true sense of Toby in that book and how wonderful he was as almost an act of glue or Velcro for Martin's emotional stability. It's kind of like
yeah.
he comes home every day and Toby is his touchstone to reality, and I really enjoy that element of your writing. You make it very sincere.
Thanks. I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly what happens. And in that particular book, Guilt and Hiding, Toby actually plays a significant sort of thematic role, because that
yes.
book is about violence and how to mitigate yes. the effects of violence. And what Proust does with Toby is really goes a long way to sort of showing how to mitigate the cascading effects of violence.
Yes. So unfortunately, I don't think we're going to have time for a second reading. I do want you to talk about any upcoming appearances you're going to be at, festivals, library events. Can you tell us anything that's on your calendar?
Sure. In another week, there's a Sterling Heights Art Festival, and as part of that's on the 29th of July, and as part of that, there's going to be a local author book fest. So I will be there at the Sterling Heights Library. 2 weeks after that, we're both going to be in Frankenmuth for Once Upon a Book,
yes.
which is going to
that's
be a
fun festival.
Event. Yeah,
I tell my friends, come for the book, stay for the chicken.
Yep, that's right. Or come for the chicken.
I was there last year, and it was a fabulous event. So I really believe you're going to have a great time this year.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm looking forward to it. And then the following week on August 19th, of course, your bookstore is opening on
yes,
that Saturday.
Yes, very excited about that. Yep.
And then in September, I'm going to do a library gig at the Ferndale Public Library, which the date hasn't been set yet, but I'm going to do it with my friend Gary Taylor, who's the president of the Ferndale Historical Society. And we're going to do a joint, he's going to talk about the real fire that happened in 1975 in Ferndale, and I'm going to talk about how I fictionalized that fire in The Forgotten Child. So that should be an interesting thing. And then
that's
we've got the Cherry Town Book
Festival.
That's
going to be a great conversation.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that's going to be, put that one on the calendar. That's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, we haven't set up a specific date for it, but it's going to be in early September.
Okay, and then Cherry Town September 10th, right?
Carrytown, September 10th. Then I'm doing a TV interview in Monroe for APN-TV, which I believe stands for Author Promotion Network TV. And then
okay.
in October, there's the Great Lakes Book Bash in Kalamazoo, October
yep.
27th and 28th.
I will see you
those
there
are the
as
last
well.
Ones. You'll be there too. Great. I think those yep. are the only yep. ones I have scheduled so far.
Yeah, I think that's plenty. Your
yeah.
calendar sounds almost your calendar sounds almost as busy as mine.
yeah. And we were both in Muskegon.
Yes. Yeah.
Which that was a fabulous event. That was really a fabulous.
It was. And then Port Huron before that.
That's right.
And
that's
then Leon and Lulu's before that.
That's right. That's right.
So, yeah, that's one of the great things I love about being part of the Michigan author community is that once you make friends with authors, you see them everywhere because you're all doing the same events together. So it's kind of like having this little posse of pals to hang out with.
Yeah, and when your bookstore opens, that's going to be the hub. That'll be the place where we can all hang out, too.
Yeah, and that's the goal. You know, we're going to have space for writers to come in and hang out with us, and space for readers and children, and special events and workshops, just a ton of great stuff. So when is the next book coming out for you?
I'm guessing it'll be out next summer. I'm just in the beginning stages of starting the pre-writing for it, the sort of idea generation. I've got the kernel of an idea for what's going to happen to it. So
Is this another book in the series?
Sorry, it's the fifth book in the series. That's right.
Okay, so it is the next book in the series. It's not something divergently new. It's just another book in the series to add to the story.
Yes, and there are also a couple of standalone projects that I'm thinking about too. So I want to get started on the next book in the series because I miss these guys. I miss Toby. I miss Martin. And I want to get back to them.
Yeah, isn't that odd how we become so attached to our characters that they become very real for us?
Yeah, yeah. You want to spend time with them.
Yes. I saw Steve Barry speak not long ago. He's an amazing historical thriller writer, just great. And he said that being a writer is an affliction, but it's a disease we all embrace thoroughly.
Yeah, that's really true. That's really true.
Yeah.
It's a it's a compulsion. It's a compulsion. I have a compulsion to write. And
absolutely.
I know you do too.
And
we all do.
Yeah. Yeah.
We all do.
Yeah. So the next event for you then will be Frankenmuth coming up. Well, no, Sterling Heights first and then Frankenmuth.
Sterling
in August,
Heights,
right?
Correct.
Okay. And tell us again what that date and time is, where the location is.
The Sterling Heights one is going to be on July 29th at the Sterling Heights Library in Sterling Heights. I think it'll be maybe 10 to 4, 10 to 5, and it'll be connected with the Sterling Heights.
Excellent.
So I'm looking forward to that.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, we will definitely put that on our calendars. And real quickly, before we sign off here, can you let us know your author website and where else people can find you on the interwebs?
Sure. My website is donaldlevin.com. Very easy to remember. I have an Amazon author. I do have an Amazon page, but I haven't under my name, of course. And I have a Facebook author page. And I have a Twitter account at Donald_Levin. So that's where you can find me.
And do you have a blog as well?
I have a blog. It's donaldlevin.wordpress.com. But I've been concentrating on the website. I should start using the blog more often, but that's where it is, donaldlevin.wordpress.com.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Don, for your time today. I really appreciate it. I'm excited about reading The Forgotten Child. I have not gotten into that one yet, but it's next on my to-be-read pile.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Wonderful to talk to you.
So thanks again for your time. Wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much, and we'll see you at the grand opening of the Scriptorium.
Great. Looking forward to it.
All right. Have a great day, sir.
Thanks. You do the same.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now.